This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. On Tuesday, federal prosecutors in the office of the Southern District of New York unsealed an indictment containing the first charges brought in the United States connected to the Panama Papers. Four people were charged with tax evasion, money laundering, and other crimes. And in case you've forgotten what the Panama Papers are, here's a reminder. 2 years ago, there was a leak. But it wasn't small. It was the biggest leak in history, and it showed us how rich people hide their money. Way higher than the tallest building in the world. All that information drawn from the internal database of Mossack Fonseca, which at the time was the world's fourth largest offshore law firm based in Panama. The Panama Papers revealed how the world's elite used tax havens to hide their wealth, and in some cases, launder money, dodge sanctions, and avoid paying taxes altogether. The papers implicated 14 heads of state and 140 politicians and connected people in more than 200 countries and territories to more than 200,000 offshore companies. So to bring you back to where we started, on Tuesday, the first charges within the U.S. were brought in connection to this massive investigation. German officials also raided the offices of Deutsche Bank last week in Frankfurt. So where does the largest document leak in the world go from here? I'm bringing in Aaron Shornick, a senior policy advisor on the anti-money laundering team at Global Witness, an investigative organization exposing corruption around the world. Hi, Aaron.
Hi.
And Will Fitzgibbon, a senior reporter for the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, ICIJ, as it's known, partner with the German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung and more than 100 other media partners to investigate the leak files. Will, thanks for joining us, too.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So, Will, let's start with the latest. Tell us about the four men who were charged this week. What do we know about them?
Well, in the Tuesday afternoon news bomb, what we learned was that two former employees of the Panama-based law firm Mossack Fonseca were charged with offences relating to alleged fraud, money laundering, and facilitating tax evasion. In addition, there was a U.S. taxpayer, so a very wealthy, wealthy U.S. individual, and his former Boston-based accountant, who were also charged with similar offenses.
What do these charges tell us about how these crimes are being examined?
Well, I think what's fascinating, first of all, is that finally we have concrete evidence that the U.S. is and has been doing something, and not only a little something, but something quite aggressive. For many years, people have asked what the US is doing, and now we finally have some answers. What we learn is that the US and the Panama Papers as a whole is not only about extremely wealthy individuals evading taxes and not paying taxes and hiding money, that investigations are also really focusing on the network of professionals, the men who wear ties and fancy suits, the women who wear high heels and fancy suits as well, and how they all go about helping wealthy people hide their money and structure transactions so that an organization like the IRS finds it impossible to know what's happening.
Aaron, I want to bring you in here. The indictments that were unsealed this week are the first time that there are charges being brought in the United States. So, two questions for you. Do we know the scale of the investigation here, and why has it taken so long for these indictments to be unsealed?
The scale of the investigation, which can be indicated by the amount of papers that were uncovered in the Panama leaks, shows that what they're dealing with is numbers and numbers and numbers that don't automatically connect. So you're going to have to involve forensic scientists, forensic accountants, all types of other professionals to crunch those numbers, look at all the data, create an argument based on that analysis. These professionals also had to investigate across borders. And what that means is that they need to go through the proper channels to access bank records or whatever information that's not easily accessible in other countries. And so the scale of the investigation is very large. It's time-consuming. And so what we see here is that, 3 years, while maybe disappointing to some, as an investigator myself and from Global Witness, we understand the difficulty it may be to obtain all the information, much less to a level where you can bring an actual criminal indictment. And so what we hope to see is that these investigators become more adept at managing this much information and that they're able to use the skills that they're continuing to progress to do this type of data analysis, to continue to bring future suits against not only the persons looking to move their money, evade taxes, use it to purchase things with ill-gotten gains, but also the professionals, as we were hearing, that help them do that, right? So many of the times you don't see these really rich people, you know, moving and creating structures themselves to evade taxes, right? They have to employ an accountant or lawyers to do it for them. And so those type of professionals are just as complicit in this type of activity.
Well, I want to ask you, there was a raid at the headquarters of Deutsche Bank in Frankfurt last week. What do we know about the outcome of that raid, and what is it that the folks were hoping to find?
Well, it's been a bad week for people in the financial services industry, I think. What we know last week, over 2 days, was that nearly 200 German tax officials, prosecutors, and investigators raided the headquarters and other offices of Deutsche Bank. We know that that raid was launched in connection with documents and activities that the Panama Papers and other leaked documents shone a light on. We know that investigators are very interested in two employees or former employees of that bank who have not been named yet. And once again, the heart of the matter seems to go to money laundering. What did this global bank do to potentially help or facilitate individuals around the world hide and move money illicitly? At this stage, what's been reported, especially in Germany so far, hasn't given us too much information about what to expect or what really is the focus, but prosecutors have said money laundering allegations and the hidden movements of a Deutsche Bank subsidiary based in the British Virgin Islands are the focus of the attention.
We're talking about the global fallout since the Panama Papers were leaked 2 years ago here on The Takeaway. Aaron, I want to ask you about this idea of having a shell company. In the United States, apparently, is one of the easiest places to set up an anonymous shell company and be able to move money around the world. What role have we played in this because of that?
You're absolutely right, Tanzina. The U.S. is the easiest place in the world to create a company. We incorporate approximately 2 million companies each year. And so what that means is that the U.S., not only because of the ease of access, but also the air of legitimacy that it provides to business persons around the world, look to incorporate in U.S. states. And no state requires that a person incorporating disclose who actually owns or controls that entity. And so what that means is I can create a company, put someone else, Will, as my nominee, and I can move dirty money all around the world using my U.S.-based company. I can use that U.S.-based company to use that dirty money to enjoy, buy a yacht, a house, fancy cars, whatever the case may be. And so what we've done is use examples like the Panama Papers to really garner the opportunity to demonstrate to congressional members, to members of parliament in the UK and around the world, that this is a real problem. It's not a victimless crime. These types of anonymous companies, which help to enable things like money laundering and tax evasions and the exact things we're seeing in the Panama Papers, are ways in which we see persons in countries who barely make $1 a day for a regular citizen. Those persons in the government using these anonymously owned companies in California, for example, to buy their mansions, stealing from the actual budgets of the state, leaving the people of that country poorer than ever and without basic infrastructure and state-offered situations for them. And so what we've seen is that in Congress in the U.S., there's an understanding that this is a problem. So what we as Global Witness are now calling for and have been for a number of years is to move forward. We are a lagger. We've got to make a law that requires owners of American companies to disclose their owners. It's that simple. Other countries around the world have done it. The UK, the overseas territories of the UK, the European Union, and others are moving toward this as well. So it's something where we've identified a problem and the solution is very, very simple and quite straightforward.
You mentioned, Aaron, some of the you said these are not victimless crimes, and I think there's also there have been some more nefarious outcomes of the Panama Papers, including the death of a Maltese journalist. And Will, I wanted to ask you what we know about that up till now, and if has anyone else been held accountable or any other laws changed as a result?
The Panama Papers, by its very nature, is something that was exposing things that very wealthy, very powerful people spent a lot of money and a lot of time trying to keep a secret, right? The childhood friend of Vladimir Putin, who was exposed in the Panama Papers, no doubt never thought he'd face the day when his name would be splashed across 100 newspapers. But there we go. Journalists who worked on the Panama Papers across the world, we're talking about journalists who worked in 100 countries, faced incredible pressures before, during, and after publication. We worked with journalists in Panama, for example, who, when the Panama Papers were published, saw their names on a Twitter poll where people were asking, what should we do with these reporters? Throw them in the sea? Put them in jail, for example? Of course, the consequences from the Panama Papers for journalists really reached their peak with the brutal assassination of a Maltese journalist, Daphne Caruana Galizia. Daphne was not an official journalist on part of the Panama Papers, but she was a famous and tenacious, brilliant investigative journalist who used what that information exposed and her own research to show some very concerning and ongoing concerns of corruption and wrongdoing by the government in Malta, which is a country at the heart of the European Union. What we've seen in terms of reaction and responses since the Panama Papers, I think, has been a mixed bag. There have been, as Aaron pointed out, some reforms. You know, Panama, which was long dragging its heels as a tax haven, basically decided it had to start cooperating with countries around the world, sharing information. We've seen countries in Australia, Germany, the United Kingdom, France, reform some of their legislation. On the other side of the coin, obviously, it's perhaps no surprise, but in countries where freedom is more restricted, where revelations touched those people very much at the inner sanctum of government, we've seen fewer outcomes. You know, there still are very senior politicians across Africa, across Latin America, across Eastern Europe and Asia, whose names were front and center of the Panama Papers, but who still enjoy their positions and still enjoy their government salaries, and I don't think wake up every morning wondering if the policeman's going to come knocking at the door.
Will Fitzgibbon is a senior reporter for the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Will, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
And Aaron Shornick is a senior policy advisor on the anti-money laundering team at Global Witness, an investigative organization that exposes corruption. Aaron, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Earlier this week, we talked about the recreational use of drones on the program. You might remember my encounter with a drone that got trapped in my fire escape and prompted the conversation. Our guest, Carnegie Mellon Professor Vivek Wadhwa, had this to say about regulations.
The government has let us down here. It has not had the discussion, it has not developed the policies, so we're in trouble.
But many of you, our listeners, pointed out that there are some rules on the books when it comes to drones. To help us better understand what those regulations are and whether they are or aren't enforced, I'm joined by Alan Levin, and he's a reporter covering aviation safety, drones, and regulation for Bloomberg. Hi, Alan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's break this drone situation down. We have commercial drones, and we have people who own hobbying drones or drones for their own personal use. Are there rules for both categories?
Yes. And in fact, just a couple months ago, Congress, I think it's fair to say, tightened the rules on the so-called recreational drones. About 5 years ago, Congress passed a law that kind of left it vague. It said on the one hand that the Federal Aviation Administration should not regulate hobbyists, but it also said the FAA could regulate safety, and that set in motion kind of a clash in a couple of cases in the courts, and Congress just wanted to clear that up. So, in fact, they clearly have rules that govern all these segments. I think it's fair to say there's somewhat of a question of how well they can enforce them, but they are moving forward on measures to make it easier to track and enforce rules on everybody.
Now, do those rules apply equally across the country, or are there different layers of rules? Are the rules different in New York City than they are, say, upstate?
So there are differences depending on where you're located. A lot of that has to do with whether you're near large airports. So in New York City, pretty much the entire airway, as it's called, you know, anything above street level, is a highly regulated, congested airspace as a result of all the big airports there. So as a result, under federal guidelines, you have to get special permission to fly anywhere in New York. And for the most part, hobbyists aren't allowed to do it. Now, there are a couple of exceptions like parks where people can fly and that sort of thing. But as a general rule, you're not supposed to fly. So as a result, it's a different standard than it would be upstate. Now, there's a whole different set of clashing standards going on between whether the federal government has primacy over this or the local governments do. So far, the federal government is maintaining it has the authority, but I do see a growing, fight over this developing in the incoming years.
Well, let's look a little bit at what the FAA website says, what their laws are. And I'll list a couple of them. They say, never fly your drone higher than 400 feet in the air. Don't fly drones near other aircrafts or near airports, and never fly them over groups of people or public events. How are those rules enforced? And the reason why I ask this is because I had to involve law enforcement to come over and deal with it, and they were equally confused about what they should do about the drone and whether they should take it and how it should be handled.
I think what you've encountered is a clear example of how this is still a work in progress. I checked in with the FAA yesterday just to make sure, and their guidance is contact local law enforcement. And the agency has made a bunch of efforts in the past years to try to educate law enforcement about what the laws are and who at each regional FAA office they should contact in the event of an incident like you encountered. But I think there's still a knowledge gap out there about what to do in these cases. And oftentimes you have an overburdened law enforcement agency and they may not have the time to figure out who to contact, and it sort of falls through the cracks.
Alan Levin is a reporter covering aviation, safety, drones, and regulation for Bloomberg. Alan, thanks again.
Oh, thank you.
Go to omahasteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut age-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to omahasteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
I think kindness is a way of being.
Most things that are done out of kindness is basically done out of love.
I think it's a behavior, a skill. It's glue. It's essential.
Kindness.
Tonight, an act of kindness at a rental car company in Tulsa goes just viral.
One really big random act of kindness.
Kindness is caring enough about others that we treat them with gentleness, graciousness, and generosity.
New tonight, a police officer's random act of kindness isn't going unnoticed.
Good and generous and sacrificing.
Once you start being kind to people, they feel better and it just spreads.
Here at The Takeaway, you've been proving to us that there's more than enough kindness to go around.
Hi, I am Danae. I live in Koreatown, Los Angeles, and Koreatown is very difficult to park in. The nice thing that I would like to report is a neighbor who, every time she travels, she allows us to use her garage, which is something that she totally doesn't have to do, but it makes such a huge difference, and we really appreciate her.
Danae Pointer was one of many listeners who came forward to nominate someone for our series, America the Kind. So we reached out to Danae and her neighbor slash parking angel, Kelly Sharbaugh. And while the gesture of sharing a garage space may seem small, Danae told me it's anything but.
With our building, we have one parking spot that's designated to our particular unit, but that means that for either my partner or myself, one of us, we draw the short straw and are stuck doing the daily drive around trying to find that spot. You have to time your day accordingly, because if you're not home by 5 o'clock, 4:30, then it's a very high likelihood that you could be stuck parking and spending $30 overnight at one of the local overnight garages or parking 8 blocks away, which has happened many times. I think we've spent around $700 collectively in the past year in tickets, and that's probably on the lower side. I know Kelly, I think you said you spent around $1,000.
Oh my God, so much. Well, yeah. I'm not a morning person, so if I ever park in a meter, it's like, you know what, I'll get a ticket. I don't want to wake up right now.
No, that's it. So it takes a lot of time and brain space to figure out the conundrum that is parking in our particular neighborhood.
But, Danae, you had a little bit of a savior here.
I came home one day and I had a note on my door from my neighbor Kelly, who I don't think I even knew Kelly's name. But one day I returned home and Kelly had left a note saying that she was going out of town. And she said, you know, I'll be gone for a week. You guys can totally use our spot. And here's my cell phone number. If you ever need anything, let me know. And it was like, oh my God, I don't know this person, but I love her. And it's funny, my partner had actually seen Kelly a lot more and had, you know, conversated with her. But through that note, I launched the group text. And, you know, sure enough, every time Kelly's gone, which she travels quite a bit, she is our local neighborhood savior. So
well, that
very
is
grateful
a,
to her.
Yeah, no, that's a pretty big, big deal, Kelly. What was the impetus behind that note, deciding that you were going to leave that for your neighbor, Janae?
You know, I ran into Dom a couple times walking my dogs, and he was just, like, so happy and, like, so, like, you know, wanting to have a conversation. And I was like, that's so nice to have that neighborly vibe. And I've lived in the building for, like, 4 or 5 years, and I don't have that with a lot of the other neighbors. So I was like, wow, like, he's just going out of his way to just, like, say good morning to me. I was like, I felt better after the conversation. I was like, maybe I can, like, reciprocate and, like, add something to his day.
I have a great boyfriend.
It sounds like you all have established a friendship.
Yeah.
We have. Yeah. For sure.
Have you learned anything, either one of you? Have you learned anything from this moment?
I mean, for me, I can speak that it's kind of showed me, like, just to slow down a little bit and just be more present and, like, the day-to-day, even if that just means, like, walking by your neighbors and, like, engaging a little bit. Because we're also used to just, like, looking down at our phones. So maybe just, like, look up and, like, just see what's there.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. Like I said, I didn't really know Kelly before this moment. Like, the quintessential neighborly activity, leaving a note on somebody's door. But, you know, it doesn't take a lot of effort to reach out, say hi, leave a note, be present. So it's something that I want to start incorporating more into my activity with my neighbors. And I feel like I'm getting to know people a bit more in the community. So I'm excited about kind of opening that up and passing that baton and spreading that love to other people where we live.
Well, Kelly and Danae, thank you so much for spreading kindness.
Thanks,
Tanzina.
That was Danae Pointer and Kelly Sharbaugh, neighbors turned friends in Koreatown, Los Angeles. You can see the other stories in the series so far at thetakeaway.org/AmericaTheKind and share the Good Samaritan in your life on Twitter with the hashtag AmericaTheKind. This week on The Takeaway, we've brought you several stories about health outcomes for Black Americans. We learn why more Black women are dying of cervical cancer in Alabama than anywhere else in the United States, and how stark racial gaps are impacting quality of life and health for African Americans in Wisconsin. Well, today we want to bring you a little bit of good news with a portrait of one community that recognized a problem and decided to fix it. For decades in the city of Sacramento, California, Black infants were dying at twice the rate of other racial groups. But Black infant deaths have decreased significantly in recent years. A new report from the Commission First Five Sacramento says there's been a 45% decrease in Black infant deaths between 2013 and 2016. Chet Hewitt is the president and CEO of the Sierra Health Foundation and co-chair of the Black Child Legacy Campaign, which has been on the front lines of this work. Chet, thanks for being with us.
Hello, Tanzia. Great to be here with you today.
Thank you so much. So give us a sense of why were Black babies dying at such a high rate in Sacramento? What did you find?
Well, as a health foundation, we know that many of the causes of the disparities in Black child mortality were really related to four primary causes. And one was a lack of access to health care, or what we would describe as perinatal conditions, infant sleep-related deaths, child abuse and neglect, and third-party homicides. And so as a community, we decided after 20 years of negative reports, this was something that needed to be addressed.
So some of the things that you outline, are those part of a larger picture of lack of insurance, of poverty? You mentioned third-party homicides, child abuse, neglect, access to health care. Tell us a little bit more about that community. What led to those conditions?
Well, like many communities across the country, Sacramento County is dealing with the racial disparities that have roots in issues around poverty and access to quality services. And so we knew that, you know, that was at the root of the challenges that we were facing. The real question was, would we have the political will and determination to really address those issues that are rooted in race and poverty-related issues?
So it sounds like you guys were able to get the political will to do that because you've actually seen some changes. Tell us a little bit about what actually was done. What has the commission done to make this change?
You know, I have to start off by acknowledging who was then a recently elected County Board of Supervisors, Phil Cerner, who received that report that stated that after 20 years, the disparity in the child death and mortality rates of African-American children had never changed, despite decreases in overall death rates for children. And it was at his request that a Blue Ribbon Commission was formed. I was fortunate enough to be part of that particular commission. And one of the recommendations that came out of that was to start a special committee that would take a look at the data we had put together and think about a plan of intervention. And that was simply to say, so what do you do about the knowledge that we now have?
And so what were some of the steps that you put in place, Chet?
Well, one of the things that we started with was to really make this a issue that was owned by the community. It was really surprising that when we released the data that showed that 82% of the preventable child deaths in the four areas I mentioned actually occurred in seven communities. So we not only did we know what the causes of death were, we knew the communities in which they were taking place. And as you stated earlier, these were not our most affluent communities. We also knew that there was clearly a racial dimension to this because of the way that Black children's mortality rates had stood out against all other children over that long period of time. And so the idea was to build real community connection, real community capacity to actually deal with these particular issues. And to have the public institutions that had been grappling with this to take somewhat of a backseat, in some ways to lead from behind and to allow the kind of authentic community voices and institutions that had been serving this community to really be out front in terms of implementing interventions.
We spoke to one mother. Her name is Tamara Walton, and she participated in Black Mothers United, which is one of the local programs that's providing this type of education and support to Black moms in Sacramento. And she gave us a sense of what her experience was. Let's take a listen.
One of the best memories I have is we had a yoga class. And I was like, I have never done yoga ever in life. What am I going to do? But it was very relaxing afterward. My son was there. He was just a couple months old. But, you know, I was able to have him there. And just to have that connection with other moms, it just kind of made me feel at ease a little bit to know that I wasn't just the only one going through everything that I was going through. There was other women that looked like me that were pregnant or have, you know, had their babies and needed assistance just as much as I did.
Chet, have you heard stories that are similar to what Tamara just described there in terms of accessing yoga and other types of solutions?
Yes, I've had many, many stories like this. And the level of support to bring yoga to communities that often don't see that type of service and to use it within the realm of promoting health and well-being is part of what's led to such dramatic decreases. And as you said, we've seen all infant death rates for Black children decrease by 45%. But what's even more amazing in many respects, and that's a pretty amazing statistic by itself, is that you've seen a disparity between all other children and Black children decrease as well. And that's decreased by 76%.
That's a pretty significant decrease there, Chet. And I'm assuming you guys have plans for continuing that decrease further.
Yeah, our community is, you know, ecstatic about the results of the interventions. And we believe that we not only have the political will to continue, but clearly the kind of community support that it's going to require to reduce or eliminate the disparity in its entirety.
Chet Hewitt is the president and CEO of the Sierra Health Foundation and the co-chair of the Black Child Legacy Campaign. Thanks for being with us, Chet.
Thank you, Nancy.
That's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
So, you want to reach us here at The Takeaway? There's a few good ways to do it. The first is on our Facebook page. Post comments there and keep up with the news of the day by following us. We're on Twitter also, at The Takeaway. And you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.